and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the testimony today by Attorney General Sessions before the House Judiciary Committee that was full of memory lapses when it came to discussions about the Trump campaign reaching out to the Russians and Putin himself. Lisa Graves, who served as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department and as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, joins us to discuss how Sessions denied that he lied to the Senate in October about contacts with Russians. But his memory suddenly got better when he recalled shooting down a proposal for a Trump-Putin meeting. We'll also examine Trump's picks for the federal judiciary, which he is rapidly filling with far-right bloggers, and assess whether the Republicans will stick with the party line and all vote for a candidate who has never tried a case and is deemed not qualified by the American Bar Association. Furthermore, this 37-year-old Hillary hater failed to disclose that his wife is the chief of staff for the White House counsel, Donald McCann, who, along with Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society, control the pipeline for lifetime appointments to the federal bench. Then we'll discuss today's hearings before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the authority to order the use of nuclear weapons, which has been prompted by bipartisan concerns that Donald Trump does not have the stability and competence to be a steward of America's nuclear arsenal and is so volatile and quixotic that he could wake up on the wrong side of the bed and order a nuclear strike. John Wolfthal, who served as a special assistant to President Obama on the National Security Council for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, joins us to analyze what barriers could be placed between Trump and the nuclear button without diminishing the deterrence value of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Then finally, we will look into the revelations in The Atlantic of secret correspondence between Donald Trump Jr. and WikiLeaks that uncover Julian Assange's close cooperation with the Trump campaign to disseminate damaging information on Hillary Clinton from Russian hacks and show how much Assange was offering advice and guidance to Trump, who he was unctuously endorsing. Michael Kelly, an editor and investigative reporter at Yahoo, who previously was a senior news editor at Business Insider, joins us to assess how leftist supporters of Assange can reconcile their hero's bromance with Donald Trump and his hard right-wing presidency. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, who served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you, Lisa. And what did you make of Jeff Sessions' bouts of amnesia today in testimony on the Hill? He did basically forget an awful lot. And I guess the one takeaway was, in terms of what's happening in Alabama with the Roy Moore scandal, he did say that he has no reason to doubt these women. A lot of the Republicans seem to be absolutely obsessed with this Uranium One story, which is, I have no idea what they're talking about, but they want to have hearings on that. But in general, he just seems to parry everybody. And I guess is he playing dumb? How would you describe it?
A little bit like a possum, I suppose. He's trying to play. I think he's trying to play this game where he says he doesn't remember anything that's germane, and in essence to suggest that he did not perjure himself and didn't lie. But more and more evidence has come about since he initially testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee that in fact he was informed of contacts between the campaign. The campaign team and Russia on more than one occasion. He claims he doesn't remember. And in this instance, he basically tried to say he didn't remember, but if he did, he stands by the idea that he rejected that suggestion from George Papadopoulos. And so, you know, I think he's in a bit of a bind. He's someone who, as Congressman Jeffries said during the hearing today, Sessions is someone who strongly supported the impeachment of Bill Clinton in part for perjury, waxed rhetorically on the Senate floor about how he prosecuted a police officer for perjury because no person should be above the law and no person should be set to a different standard on perjury. And yet here you have the Attorney General of the United States who has maintained, I think unconvincingly, that he has no recollection of contacts with the Russians, that he didn't have meetings with the Russians while he was serving a dual role as a senator and as a campaign surrogate. And yet it turns out he had more than one meeting himself with the Russian ambassador, and he also was in meetings where discussions of having campaign members go to Russia, talk with the Russians, were also discussed. And so he comes off to me as someone who is certainly not truthful and not being truthful.
Well, let's turn to the real lasting horrors. I don't know how much longer. Obviously, Trump would like to get Sessions out of there and maybe try and save that situation down in Alabama. I don't think Sessions wants to leave the Attorney General job. He likes it. He doesn't want to go back to being the senator from Alabama to rescue the Republicans from Steve Bannon's choice of Roy Moore. But in the broader sense, the people that they're pushing through in the judiciary, as dysfunctional as Trump's presidency has proven to be, the one area where they are showing tremendous speed and skill, and that is filling the federal judiciary with arch-conservative judges. And some of the judges that have gotten through so far are just so shocking. For example, this fellow, John Bush, he's now a lifetime appellate judge. He blogged under a pseudonym of G. Morris and promoted birtherism conspiracies, reposted threats to shoot Barack Obama's supporters, lied to the Senate, and yet got confirmed on a party line vote. And then this fellow Damian Schiff, another right-wing blogger, he believes that Medicare, Social Security are unconstitutional. He called Justice Anthony Kennedy a judicial prostitute. He's poised to be confirmed. But the one that's getting attention is this guy, Brett Talley, who could be on a lifetime appointment to the federal judiciary at any moment. He's been deemed not qualified by the American Bar Association. Now it turns out that his wife works for the White House counsel. Ann McDonald is the chief of staff to the White House counsel, Don McGahn, who is basically, you know, filling the judiciary. He's the sort of right there in the pipeline, if not the main player, along with Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society. So this guy has never... He's only been a lawyer, what, about three years,
right.
never tried a case. And it turns out not only is a crazy right-wing blogger, he also is a part of the Tuscaloosa Paranormal Research Group, and has a cult following, and he's written books titled Haunted Tuscaloosa, Haunted Alabama Black Belt, and The Reborn. Hmm. All of these, you know, he's like a discount version, if you will, of Stephen King. So, I mean,
I think you may be praising him. You may be praising him too much, even with the discount version there.
Right. Well, but it's just like, where would you find people like this? Let alone, surely the entire judiciary, including the Chief Justice and the people on the Supreme Court, they've got to be thinking that their whole profession is being slimed by these unqualified lunatics.
It's shocking, quite frankly, the type of people that the Trump team has put forward for the judiciary. And it's also shocking that the Republicans in charge of the Senate have not blinked an eye in confirming these number of people who are plainly unfit to be judges, to be lifetime judges on our federal courts. It shows how empty the rhetoric they've had over these many years of supposed opposition to judicial activism, supposed commitment the rule of law. This shows how committed they actually are to just naked power and to trying to use our court system to enact their most extreme vision of America through these judges. And it's appalling, quite frankly, that the Senate would even be considering confirming someone who has practiced law for, you know, only about 3 years and not even really practiced law in the sense of as a trial lawyer or even an appellate lawyer to be given a position as a judge. I wouldn't appoint him, you know, a mediator, let alone a county judge, let alone a state court, you know, judge, a Supreme Court judge for a state, let alone federal judge. This guy has no business being a judge anywhere. He doesn't have the temperament to be a judge. His entire limited record that he has shows that he does not have the impartiality or fairness necessary for being entrusted with making impartial rulings that affect the lives of the people who come before him. In fact, his record demonstrates that he is the opposite of that, that he's someone who has an extremely right-wing ideological point of view, that he has a penchant for extraordinary rhetoric, that he, you know, is someone who is simply not suitable, not qualified, not experienced enough to be a federal judge. And he's just the tip of the iceberg, as you point out. There's a whole slate of these people that these Republicans, that the White House has chosen hand in glove with the Federal Society and with other right-wing extremist sorts of advocates to put on our federal court system. It demeans our federal judiciary. It weakens the public respect for our federal courts. And I think ultimately it will lead to a number of really outlandish and outrageous decisions being pushed by these people who are not should not be entrusted with such a position of enormous trust in our federal court system, in our system of our checks and balances in our federal government.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. So what's the understanding amongst the judiciary and the legal profession in general? I thought the American Bar Association was largely taken seriously when they recommend or assess nominees for the federal bench. And rarely do they say that a nominee is not qualified, as they have in the case of Brett Talley. Again, I go back to the Chief Justice and others who talk about the majesty of the law and all of that stuff that they go on about during their confirmations, you know, almost sort of like Vatican talk, you know, when they're going through confirmation. And yet you've got somebody that's an absolute joke and a disgrace. So where does the ABA stand in terms of its gravitas, and why aren't they taking it seriously?
Well, I think, I think what happened, what happened actually almost two decades ago was that George W. Bush, at the advice of the right wing and at the behest, in essence, of the Federal Society and more, kicked the American Bar Association out of the process before nomination. And so it used to be in the Clinton administration when I worked on judicial nominations that you would await before nomination an advisory view from the American Bar Association, which represents, which is the association for the lawyers in the country and has a committee with lawyers who are esteemed in the field, who conduct interviews about whether a person who is being suggested for a judgeship has the temperament and experience for that role. And then if the ABA were to give a recommendation that the person would not be qualified, then the Clinton administration might not go forward with that nomination. In fact, you know, would likely seek another candidate. What happened with Bush was he pushed the ABA's process to after the nomination occurs. And now with this Congress, they're not even waiting for the ABA's rating before they hold hearings on these guys. So the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Republicans leading the Senate, have basically indicated that they don't care for the views of the actual profession that includes numerous lawyers and also, you know, judges who've been part of the ABA. And in this instance, you have a vote across the board by every single member of that ABA standing committee against the qualifications of Mr. Talley. And it's no wonder. I mean, it's not a shock that it's unanimous that he's unqualified, because if there were a standard below unqualified, he would earn it. He is so far removed from whatever would be the baseline qualifications. He couldn't make partner at a law firm, let alone a lifetime appointment to a judgeship, if there were any justice or fairness in the world. And so I think that it's a sad day for America that the right wing has taken hold of our United States Senate and is acting in derogation of their responsibilities to give advice and consent to actually meaningfully advise on whether someone is fit and suitable to have this lifetime position, a position in which this guy could be on the court for the next 40, 50, or even 60 years if he lived to a ripe old age. long after Trump is gone, and wreak all sorts of havoc on people's lives. And so it's a terrible miscarriage of justice. It's a miscarriage of the responsibilities of the Senate to proceed in this way and to ignore the advice, and in fact not even listen to the advice of the profession about this man's qualifications and some of the other nominees who have been put forward by Trump and have been moved by that Senate.
Well, it's you wonder what's in the water down there in Alabama with this guy Talley from Alabama and of course Roy Moore, but there's a cronyism that we've never seen before in the Trump administration. And nepotism just a breathtaking scale. You got the son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as an emissary of the White House, running around the Middle East, shaking down potentates to bail him out from a bad investment he made when he was courting Ivanka and bought the most expensive piece of real estate in Manhattan just before the 2008 crash. It's got a $1.2 billion balloon payment due at the end of next year, and he's shaking down the Qatari royals for $500 million and then threatening the blockade, which they told him to go get lost, and sure enough, the blockade happens. So we've never seen that. We've never seen a national security advisor, albeit a very brief tenure that Michael Flynn had, but in that tenure, he worked for the government of Turkey. He actually did their bidding over the United States and held back on the Kurds taking Raqqa and delayed that offensive by months at the behest of Erdogan, who was going to pay him $15 million. So those are breathtaking just in themselves. But it feels as though there's trickle-down nepotism here with Don McCann, the White House counsel, having his chief of staff, Ann Donaldson, nominate her husband, Brett Talley, who's completely unqualified.
I mean, it's astonishing that he also failed to disclose that fact to the Senate Judiciary Committee, that his wife was working in the White House counsel's office for the person who has the penultimate say to recommend to the president who gets nominated. And that's astonishing. But as you point out, that's just one more astonishing fact after another of the incredible level of incompetence and mendaciousness and greed, quite frankly, of a whole host of people put into positions of power by Trump or his inside team. And, you know, that article about Jared Kushner's business history, his so-called business experience that was in Vanity Fair, I think, this past month, was incredible. It was so important to see because he had virtually no experience running anything successfully, and yet because he, I suppose, reminds Trump of himself as a young man who was, you know, did not have much experience but had a lot of money. He has now been put in charge of all sorts of substantive public policy that affects people's lives, and matters of life and death are in the hands of Jared Kushner, who failed at the two major business enterprises that he ever undertook in his brief experience. And yet, because he is the son-in-law of Trump, he has been given this role that he's not qualified for, and that he, you know, it appears, as you point out, that he has ulterior motives for his own personal financial circumstances in pushing things a certain way. I think you're right. This is unprecedented. It's certainly in the modern era of American democracy for there to be this level of corruption, this level of nepotism, this level of incompetence. We've just never seen anything like this. This makes the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, look like it was almost an A student, and clearly it was not.
Well, just in closing, though, it does seem that there's a general disrespect for the law. We know Trump has no respect for the law, and he uses the law proactively to punish anybody that would complain that they got ripped off by him, etc. So his attitude to the law is pretty clear. But I don't understand how, and most of the Congress are lawyers, so most of those Republicans are lawyers, and what's going on in their head where they're making excuses, and they're going to, people down in Alabama are going to vote for a pedophile to be in the United States Senate. I mean, the guy's an absolute disgrace, and he should be in jail, I mean, let alone in the U.S. Senate. But they're making excuses for him, and now they're voting like a bunch of sheep for these manifestly unqualified people. What is going on with these Republican lawyers in our Congress.
I can't believe what's happening in terms of Alabama and Roy Moore. You know, you have four women, some of whom are Republicans. I guess now five women. One or more of them voted for Trump. They didn't know each other. They come forward. They allege really outrageous behavior by Roy Moore as a district attorney, trolling high school girls, and according to the witness yesterday, sexually assaulting her, almost completing the act of raping her. And yet Republicans in some Republicans, and certainly Republican leaders, if you could use that word, I use it only formally, leaders in Alabama are standing by Roy Moore despite the evidence against him. And you have a number of senators, although some have walked back their support for him, but you still have a number of senators who have not called for him to step down, step away from that election. And the fact that this is even a question for the GOP just shows how far down the rabbit hole we've come. The idea that Trump is holding his tongue but until he comes back, well, he's not holding his tongue on anything else, but he's not speaking on this issue until he supposedly gets back to the United States, that he, with his own history of numerous allegations and evidence of his own sexual harassment and predatory behavior toward women, would tell Roy Moore to step away, you know, that's a fantasy, because I don't see Donald Trump having the character to say any such thing, unless he, I suppose, thinks that he can gain personally from that. But these are standards that you never thought could be could fail. No one who's been accused of being a pedophile, who's been accused of rape by a 16-year-old girl, has any business getting votes from any person of common sense for the United States Senate. It's just appalling. It's morally abhorrent. And the idea that pastors would write in support of Roy Moore just shows how far they've fallen away from the faith that they profess to hold so dear.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. We can take a brief station break and back look into today's hearings before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on whether Trump has the stability and competence to be a steward of America's nuclear arsenal.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole less truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Wolfsthal, who is a non-resident scholar at the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. From 2014 to 2017, he served as special assistant to President Barack Obama as senior director for arms control and nonproliferation at the National Security Council. And from 2009 to 2012, he was a special advisor to U.S. Vice President Joe Biden for nuclear security and nonproliferation, and as a director for nonproliferation on the National Security Council. He's the co-author with Joe Cirincione of Deadly Arsenals, Tracking Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Wolfsthal.
Thanks for having me.
And today there were Senate hearings, and Corker, of course, the Senate chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, called them. He is taking an unusual step. Most of the Republican senators and House members have shown a fealty towards Donald Trump, but he has not, and he's spoken out about his concerns about President Trump's stability and competence. And I must say that listening to him and also to Senator Murphy, we have reason to be concerned. From your point of view of having dealt with this issue on the National Security Council with both President Obama and Vice President Biden, are we in unprecedented territory here?
Well, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. And I hate to give you sort of a Washington answer, but I mean, there's no doubt that President Trump is unprecedented in terms of his willingness to just ignore norms of behavior, any, you know, measure of composure and calm demeanor has been cast out the window. And when it comes to nuclear weapons, a lot of what we have are norms of behavior and codes of conduct. And so in some ways, this is unprecedented. But I think it was also important that the senators and witnesses today pointed out no president, whether it is a Republican or a Democrat, has any constraints on his ability to use nuclear weapons. The president can order them. The Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs have no role in approving or disapproving those orders. They don't even have to know about a president's order to use nuclear weapons. What we have traditionally done in the past is hold a discussion with senior advisors before the president considers such steps. But as we've seen with Donald Trump, he doesn't do what other presidents have done. And so I think it's a recognition, the Senate hearings today, a recognition that the Senate has a role to play and the Congress has a role to play, and that no president, Republican or Democrat, should have total unfettered use of nuclear weapons. It's the last vestige of a monarchy in this country and one that I think the Congress is correctly engaging on.
Well, my understanding is that the evolution of the football and the nuclear codes and the total authority of the president to order a nuclear attack was always predicated on the idea that you needed, if the early warning system at NORAD saw an enemy missiles coming inbound or bombers, or the U.S. would immediately retaliate, and that's why the time factor is so important, because you've only got about 5 minutes to make a decision and to verify that you're under attack. So my understanding is the authority of the president to have unlimited authority, if you will, to launch nuclear weapons is predicated upon his ability to retaliate. But is there a gray area in terms of his ability to initiate a strike?
Well, so right now there's no distinction in terms of how the president would operate. But I think the hearing today and the measures that are being introduced in Congress draw exactly that distinction. So on the one hand, our ability to deter our enemies, Russia or somebody else with nuclear weapons, does rest in part on the credible threat that the American president will be able to retaliate. Russia does not use nuclear weapons against us for a whole host of reasons, but the bottom line is that if it were to do so, it would be destroyed. And so the president shouldn't need to check with Congress or anyone else if he's going to retaliate, because that threat needs to be credible for deterrence to work. However, we are now in a situation where the United States reserves the right to use nuclear weapons first in a crisis. And Donald Trump has used very alarmist language in terms of raising the concern that we might strike first militarily and possibly even using nuclear weapons against North Korea. And so one of the big parts of the discussion today was not whether the president should have the right to retaliate or in quick time make a decision. The question is, and I like the way one of the witnesses pointed out, that you know, if the military wakes up the president, that's an imminent threat, and he needs the authority to do what he needs to do. If the president wakes up the military, that is not an imminent threat, and there should be controls on the president's ability to use nuclear weapons in those circumstances. A strike out of the blue, an initiation of hostilities with a country using nuclear weapons is something that would clearly qualify as a declaration of war, which under the Constitution belongs to the Congress, not the president.
So is there a way then to devise, and I'm sure this is what is under discussion here and under review, a regime where you don't undermine deterrence? You know, you obviously can't have a committee when you've only got 5 minutes to decide the fate of the world, but also come up with a regime that would constrain the president and require him to sort of go through some kind of protocol in order to initiate a nuclear attack.
So that is exactly why these hearings were useful and hopefully will be the first of many, because I think there are a number of very complicated questions like this. Should the president have to also get the authorization from either the vice president or a Senate-confirmed officer such as the Secretary of Defense or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. In a crisis, it may be hard to get one or even all of them. But conceivably, you can access one of the three or four top officers, and there's a question about whether they should be included in the chain of command. Also, the president, if he wants to use any other part of our military, must give an order to the Secretary of Defense, who then gives a written order to his subordinates. In the nuclear arena, that's not the case. He can pick up the phone and communicate directly with commanders in the field to use weapons. And so the question is, should the Secretary of Defense be put into that chain of command to authorize the release of nuclear weapons? Those are two very reasonable questions, and the Congress can work through some of the procedures. Are there circumstances where that would be required to be legal? If that's not the case under those circumstances, would the military have a legal responsibility to refuse that order? Under the Military Code of Justice, military officers not only have the option of refusing an unlawful order, they have an obligation to refuse an unlawful order. So the problem right now is that all of this is under the purview only of the executive branch. Congress has not chosen to educate itself or to intervene. And so the question of balance of power and checks and balances is, I think, now being reestablished, in part because Donald Trump has brought this issue to a head.
Well, it is. I think we're, and I'm sure you would agree, that we're lucky to have survived the Cold War. There were so many near misses, particularly, for example, Abel Archer in 83, where it's all basically based on perceptions. And we think of ourselves as being virtuous and we'd never strike with nuclear weapons, even though we reserve that right. But the gerontocracy in the Kremlin misinterpreted a NATO exercise and thought it was a feint for a real attack. And it was based upon their perceptions of Ronald Reagan talking about the Soviet Union ending up on the ash heap of history. Theirs was a system that didn't distinguish between rhetoric and reality. So they took it seriously when Cap Weinberger talked about nuclear decapitation. So I find that this present president we have, Donald Trump, is actually even more reckless in many ways. And Ronald Reagan, you know, obviously he was taunting the wounded bear there for the longest time, and then he had a complete reversal, and along with Gorbachev, ended the Cold War. But there seems to be a kind of capricious, casual, almost a fetish with nuclear weapons. So many times Trump has said the strangest things about nuclear weapons, urged the South Koreans and the Japanese to get nukes, wondered why, if we have them, we don't use them. Apparently, in a early briefing in Trump Tower, talked about what would happen, or asked questions about what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit New York. Is there something going on with him in terms of some peculiar fetish here with nuclear weapons and speaking so casually? I don't think there's anything more serious, frankly, than the portent of ending the world.
Well, I firmly agree with you. And you know, I want to be careful here. On the one hand, I want the president to understand what nuclear weapons are, what they're capable of doing. And no president comes in prepared to be the controller of a massive nuclear arsenal. There's just nothing in life that will prepare you for that. So I have no problem with Donald Trump or any president asking questions to understand what these issues are and to be educated. But I agree with you that he has spoken about nuclear weapons with a very uninformed and almost casual attitude. And he has made veiled threats, which actually increase the risk of accidents and miscommunication and miscalculation leading to conflict, which could go nuclear. And that's nowhere have we seen that more acutely than in the Korean Peninsula, where now, because of his loose talk and really irresponsible statements, there's no doubt that the leadership in North Korea believe that the United States is at least considering military force. And North Korea believes that they would need to use nuclear weapons early in a crisis in order to save their skins. And so, you know, Donald Trump once famously criticized President Obama for talking too loosely about the fact that we were going to liberate Mosul and you don't give your enemies advance notice. I mean, at the time, we were assembling hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of troops, and so people were going to notice that. But I would argue the same is true for Donald Trump, that you don't lightly make nuclear threats that you may have to carry out, because it increases the risk that somebody's going to strike at you first. And so I have been concerned, and I think clearly the Senate is concerned about the way the president has managed these issues. That's one of the reasons for the hearing today, but not by any means the only reason.
So my question about perceptions being important, particularly how other people see us, does that concern you in the South, in the Korean context, with telling the North Korean leader that threatening him with fire and fury? And he, of course, has been saying the craziest things for the longest time. And apparently a lot of his own people believe that they could actually not only survive a nuclear war, win a nuclear war. There are some doubts about whether it's posturing or whether they are truly that lunatic. But this would indicate to me that this is not a pot that you want to stir.
There's no doubt that our allies in South Korea and, to a slightly lesser extent, Japan are extremely nervous as a direct result of Donald Trump's behavior and statements. And that's not just related to the nuclear issue. I think there are many South Koreans that are worried the United States might launch an attack on North Korea without their consultation or even permission. It's one of the reasons you've seen the South Korean President Moon announce that he will not allow the United States to launch nuclear or military strikes without his explicit consent, which he doesn't have the legal authority to do, but he's making a political pronouncement to make clear that he does. But at the same time, the president has almost gone out of his way to undermine the confidence that our allies have in our commitment to their security. When he suggested that South Korea might have to pay for the missile defenses we were going to deploy there, when he said that the free trade agreement we have with South Korea might have to be redone or undone because he felt that it was an unfair trade deal in the middle of a nuclear crisis, that raised questions about where his priorities lay and what priorities he might have should South Korea be attacked. And in Japan, I think similar things are true. And so it's not just his behavior in the nuclear field which has our allies concerned. It is this America first, America alone concept, which quite frankly undermines our ability to be secure, because of course our security depends on our close relationships with our allies and our mutual defense agreements. And so the behavior across the board has been one that I think increases the risk of conflict and ultimately could lead countries like South Korea and Japan to consider their own nuclear weapons options, something that's increasingly politically popular in South Korea, despite many, many years of effort to try to convince them that we will be by them no matter what.
Well, just in closing, John Wolfsall, clearly there is a political subtext to what the Senate committee was asking about today in terms of Senator Corker's early remarks. He's concerned about the president's stability. I think that's pretty unambiguous. And lots of talk, of course, about impeachment. This would seem to me an issue where the president is vulnerable, because it's not a question of innocent to prove guilty. It's almost as if the situation is so grave, you ought to be able to reverse the situation and force the president to prove that he has the mental stability and to be a steward of this vast arsenal. If he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, he could destroy the world. That's an unacceptable situation, and we as citizens of the world should not have to live with that possibility.
I agree with you, and I think the question is, will the Senate, which I think senators on both sides today showed both serious engagement and some thought to this issue, but will this lead to a process that either convinces the executive branch that it needs to modify its own procedures, or will the Senate and Congress try to pass legislation that might constrain the president's authority? I think that latter effort is unlikely to succeed, even with a Democratic president. Presidents generally don't like to yield or cede authority to Congress, just as Congress doesn't like to cede authority to the president. But at the same time, I think the recognition that President Trump is unlike any president may convince people that we need to rein in the most extreme contingencies because of the consequences of action. And this is not like a small fire, or even, God forbid, friendly fire episode where an American soldier gets killed. A mistake here could lead to the destruction of entire cities and millions of people. And so I think it's a good thing that the Congress has started to engage on this issue, but I hope that it's just the first step in a long process.
Well, John Wolfsall, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with John Mosal, who is a non-resident scholar at the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace from 2014 to 2017. He served as special assistant to President Barack Obama as senior director for arms control and non-proliferation at the National Security Council. And from 2009 to 2012, he was a special advisor to U.S. Vice President Joe Biden for nuclear security and non-proliferation, and as a director of the non-proliferation at the National Security Council. He is the co-author with Joseph Cerincione of Deadly Arsenals, Tracking Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break. You're back looking into the revelations in the Atlantic of secret correspondence between Donald Trump Jr. and Julian Assange of WikiLeaks.
At least it's not the end of the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Kelly, who's an editor and investigative reporter at Yahoo. He was formerly senior news editor at Business Insider, where he reported on military and defense. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Kelly.
Hi, nice to be here.
So we've spoken in the past about Edward Snowden and also about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And it's come back into the news, of course, with the report by The Atlantic's Julia Joffe releasing quite a bit of correspondence between WikiLeaks and Donald Trump's oldest son, Donald Trump Jr., that is clearly being seen in, by many as a sort of smoking gun in this continuing investigation into Russian involvement in the American election. But what do you think the effect is going to be? I find it extraordinary that, for example, on the political left, a lot of people see Julian Assange as a hero. But what these exchanges between Donald Trump Jr. and Assange reveal is that Assange is essentially working for Trump as a volunteer, and they're actually giving them advice of how to beat Hillary Clinton and essentially how to make use of material that he in fact got from the Russians. So I find it extraordinary that there's this kind of paradox out there where you can't love Julian Assange and Donald Trump at the same time. That's a bit of a stretch, I would say.
Yeah, it's become a very complicated situation for someone trying to decide how they feel about this situation. I think that in terms of the impact, the direct messages between Donald Trump Jr. and Julian Assange, I think that will be one part of a larger investigation into how Russia and people aligned with Russia attempted to influence the 2016 presidential election. And with the what the direct messages show is that and we don't know if these are all of the direct messages because some could have been deleted or not handed over. But what they show is that Assange was giving tips and advice to Trump unsolicited, Trump Jr. And Trump Jr. wasn't really responding much, but sometimes there would be reactions from Donald Trump himself. So, for example, on one of the direct messages WikiLeaks sends to Donald Trump Jr., strongly suggest your dad tweets this link if he mentions us. And this is on October 12th, 2016, so we're talking less than a month before the election. He says that, you know, there are a lot of great stories that the press are missing. This is right in the middle of WikiLeaks releasing on a daily basis emails from Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta. And Donald Trump Jr. does not respond to that message, but 15 minutes after it was sent, Donald Trump himself, the Republican candidate, answers or tweets out, "Very little pickup by the dishonest media of incredible information provided by WikiLeaks. So honest, rigged system." So there were these direct messages seem to be having an effect on the Trump campaign. And I think that that's one aspect that Special Prosecutor Bob Mueller is looking at, of how Russia and Russia-aligned actors actually materially influenced the election.
Well, I would think that Mueller's got quite a task on his hand, because there does seem to be other kind of links in this web involving WikiLeaks. For example, Cambridge Analytica, who did a lot of work on both Brexit and on the Trump campaign in terms of digital targeting, for example, they were apparently in touch with WikiLeaks. Roger Stone was in touch with WikiLeaks. Also, Nigel Farage, the head of UKIP and one of the main proponents of Brexit. So do you have any sense of that web of intrigue?
Well, we know how the U.S. government and the U.S. intelligence community views WikiLeaks, especially in reference to the 2016 election. They basically called them out as a conduit for emails that were hacked by Russia. So they were basically acting as an asset, directly or indirectly, of Russian intelligence as they were actively trying to influence the election. And even before this election, even years before, intelligence officials that I've spoken with considered WikiLeaks to be an asset to Russian intelligence. So I think that Bob Mueller has that same suspicion of WikiLeaks, and I think that it will be one part of a very large investigation into Russian espionage, which by its nature is going to be very complicated, because Russia is very good at this kind of thing.
Well, presumably, if the Russians have used WikiLeaks, which appears to be the case in terms of the DNC hack and the subsequent data dump, and also I imagine it was also the hack into Podesta's email as well, is there any evidence of who and what finances WikiLeaks? If they're some kind of an asset of Russian intelligence, would the Russians therefore be financing them through some sort of series of cutouts?
Yes, that's a big question. They're in the public record. There is no evidence or indication that Russian money is flowing into or has flowed into WikiLeaks. That's something that former U.S. officials have mentioned, whether they suspected it or the U.S. government has data on that. The strongest connection that I've found is that WikiLeaks, their website was hosted at least partially on the premises of a Russian hosting company in Moscow, east of Moscow, HostKey. And they're basically, they had one IP address that had been there since 2011, and another was moved there in August of 2016. And this is from Citizen Lab, internet researchers at the University of Toronto, when they were asked by Andrei Soldatov, a Russian investigative journalist for Red Web. He wrote a new book called Red Web. He released a new chapter, and this information is in there. So basically, if Russian intelligence has, they know where you're hosted in east of Moscow, Russian law are able, this intelligence services are able to get into your servers. That's why they want to have social media companies move their servers to Russia, because that means that Russian intelligence would have fair game. So the fact that WikiLeaks is a website that presents themselves as transparency but they're leaking information, uncurated, and they turn out to launder information that was hacked by Russian intelligence, all the while having IP addresses hosted in Russia. That's a big indicator. And I suspect in the months and years to come, the U.S. government may provide more indication of what they believe that nexus to be, if the public doesn't wake up more to what WikiLeaks is and what their motivations are.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Kelly, who's an editor and investigative reporter at Yahoo. He's previously a senior news editor at Business Insider, where he reported on military and defense. Well, some of the complicity here between Assange and WikiLeaks and the Trump campaign via Donald Trump Jr. is pretty extraordinary. The advice, you know, how to get out from under your father's problems with the tax returns. And then the most extraordinary is that the suggestion is after Trump won the election, WikiLeaks suggested that Trump should prod Australia to appoint Julian Assange as Australia's ambassador to the United States.
Yeah.
That is surreal, to say the least. But what's going on with this kind of peculiar megalomania that it's hard to kind of reconcile with a guy that's holed up in a room in the Ecuadorian embassy, somehow thinking he's ruling the world or manipulating the world? It's pretty heady stuff. He's not Rupert Murdoch. He's not a kingmaker, but he certainly sounds like it, that he thinks he is.
WikiLeaks, that's why they've been pegged as a non-state hostile intelligence actor by the U.S. government is because they've been very effective in what they've put their energies towards. Even though Julian Assange is basically holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy for the last 5 years, that also means that he's out of reach to Western authorities. Or for years, he originally holed up in there to be out of reach for Swedish authorities. So if he's operating on the internet and being fed information, then his platform, which has grown quite a bit since the Chelsea Manning situation in 2010-2011, he can be very effective. And especially if he's working as a one-step remove asset or cutout of Russian intelligence, because Russia knows how to run a deception operation with the best of them. They're probably the best at it in terms of government. So, he's an influential character, and he's definitely a problem for the U.S.
Well, one would think, though, that this release of these communications between Donald Trump Jr. and Julian Assange, as incriminating as they are, that it would maybe take some of the scales off the eyes of people on the left who think Assange is a hero. But we'll wait and see. But what's your sense then of, I think when we last talked, we were trying to figure out what went on with Snowden in Hong Kong in that critical period when he met with The Guardian and The Washington Post and Glenn Greenwald, and then somehow ended up in Russia. And At the time, I talked to the lawyer for Snowden's father, who was very concerned for his son and was trying to see if he could get his son out of trouble. And the lawyer for Snowden's father told me that the WikiLeaks and the Russians were all over the situation there in Hong Kong. So did Assange sort of jump on the bandwagon there, or how did he get involved in the exfiltration of Edward Snowden from Hong Kong to Russia, where he's been holed up ever since?
Yeah, that's a very big question, and some is unknown. I'm actually working on a story right now, so I don't quite want to scoop myself. But basically what happened is that Edward Snowden identified himself with a video on The Guardian on June 9th, 2013. And then on June 10th is the earliest indication of when WikiLeaks became involved. That's when Julian Assange sent his colleague and girlfriend, Sarah Harrison, from Australia to Hong Kong to try to find, basically try to find Snowden asylum outside of China, of Hong Kong. And in Assange's mind, we learned much later that Assange told Snowden, advised Snowden that you should go to Russia. That's the only place you'll be safe. The U.S. can get you pretty much anywhere else. So he was basically pushing Snowden to go to Russia. And at that point, in mid-June, at some point in there, Edward Snowden, according to U.S. authorities, met with Russian officials, most likely based on reported CCTV footage. He went to the Russian consulate in Hong Kong. And then on June 23rd, Edward Snowden and Sarah Harrison of WikiLeaks fly to Russia. And at that point, once he arrives in Moscow, you know, people, his new Russian lawyer, who Anatoly Kucherina, who sits on the public board of the FSB, the Domestic Intelligence Services of Russia, he's very close to the Kremlin. Basically, Russia is going to take over the situation from there. So the role of Assange and WikiLeaks in this was basically, we can say that they became involved after Snowden identified himself and shepherded him onto that Aeroflot plane to Russia. And as we know, that's where Edward Snowden remained. So it's a very crucial period for Snowden. Assange, even Snowden and Glenn Greenwald, one of the journalists who worked with Snowden, credited Assange and WikiLeaks for, doing that. And the situation we have is that Snowden is in exile and a de facto defection in Russia.
Well, Michael Kelly, let's do a follow-up when your new piece is published. I'd like to talk further about it, and I thank you
for
joining us.
Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Kelly, who's an editor and investigative reporter at Yahoo. He was previously a senior news editor at Business Insider, where he reported on military and defense. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was